You're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. 2 years before I started in radio, back in 1970, there were a slew of clergy, priests who would show up in New York, Chicago, many areas. Many of them were missionaries. Many of them were, indeed, for very good reason, coming here because the slates would be missing from the roof of the chapel at home. And where else would you come to first but New York City? There was a priest who showed up, and he was from Limerick. And he was not at all, as far as we could see, he was a Holy Ghost father, but he was connected. He was born in Ireland. He was a missionary, as was his brother Jack. And so that when I was just starting off, again, going back to my opening remark there, this guy, Father Angus Finucane, was a guest on my program, and even then, there were a great number of people who were saying that with all of the trouble in Ireland, with all of the trouble in the north, and with all of the issues that Ireland had, times were rough. What is this guy doing over here talking about third world countries and telling us about how rough things were in Africa and Asia and Haiti and whatever? He, of course, was the founder of Concern Worldwide, and it is a long road, of course, that was 45 years ago. Concern Worldwide has indeed, there are very few people, and definitely not in the Irish circles, who don't know about the work of Concern Worldwide. And we do know, of course, that the chairman of Concern Worldwide is Tom Moran. And he's also the chairman, the president, and CEO of Mutual of America. And at the beginning of this year, Tom Moran was indeed very excited about having the appointment of my guest this morning, Joseph Cahalan, who was named Chief Executive Officer of Concern Worldwide, United States, USA. I welcome the Chief Executive Officer and Joe Cahalan, you're very welcome.
Adrian, thanks for having me.
That was by way of a very long introduction there, but I think it's well worth, you know, tracing the roots for Concern. Many times, I think, no matter which country one is in, whenever there is disaster and natural disasters, political disasters, where people are practically dead or half dead, Concern and the banner Concern shows up in those 15-second you know, clips that we see on television and so forth. And most people don't know that it is such an enormous world NGO organization.
I think that's right. And I'm not sure I totally understand the reasons. One reason is, though, that we're extraordinarily frugal with our money. So of the money that we take in to help people in Asia and Africa and Haiti, 92% of the money that we take in goes to programs in the field. which leaves obviously 8% to pay staff and heat the offices and pay the rent. So we don't have a lot of money left over to buy advertising or do things of that, which is why I'm grateful to have the opportunity to be on your show, so we can start to get the word out a little more to a broader segment of people.
3,200 personnel working in 25 different countries in Africa, in Asia, the Caribbean or the Caribbean. That is an enormous number of people who have obviously, first of all, the vocation, to work in these areas. Sometimes we get a feeling that the only time that we hear from many of these NGOs is when there is a disaster, indeed, just like we had this last week where, typhoon, hits the Philippines, and you're not sure whether that's 10,000 people or maybe could be 15,000 people who are wiped out in a matter of minutes. We don't think of the work, say, of concern when there isn't an immediate emergency. And I think that's a good starting point to say, to tell us about concern and what they do outside of the emergency.
Right. Well, you're right. Our work comes in two flavors, sort of. The disaster relief, which maybe we'll talk about a little later. There's a hot one going on right now as we're doing this show. But the other part of the work, and the work that really consumes more of our people and funding, is development work. So often when we go into a disaster situation, it's in one of the most challenging environments in the world. But we don't leave. Typically, when we go in a disaster situation, it's not always the case for reasons we could talk about, but typically we stay, and that's how we get involved. And then our work becomes, okay, let's get through this disaster. As I like to say, clothe and feed the hungry.
Right.
But then we stay, and we offer a variety of programs to help people help themselves in education, in health, and in job skills, and learning how to make a living.
Right. Now, talk, if you will, about, say, as opposed to natural disasters, and God knows, anybody who lives in the East Coast here got this time last year, got a first-hand experience, and when it lands on our own doorstep, maybe that brings a new awareness to all of us that actually this is not something that's at, some corner of the world in a place that we may not even be able to find readily on a map. But tell us about, first of all, the disasters that are politically responsible, that are the result of horrendous government leadership, and how do you manage to be welcome to stay in that environment after the immediate emergency is taken care of?
Well, that's a great question. Like, for example, we're in Syria now, which is a man-made political disaster. We're working actually in Lebanon along the border where refugees are coming across the border. So that will depend almost entirely on how that civil war resolves itself and who we would deal with. But in most cases, concern has a terrific reputation on the ground. I can't tell you. There's such a disparity, which you pointed out at the opening of the show, between a lot of people, including some people in the Irish American community, but people in the general public not knowing concern. But where we work and in the communities we work in, like at USAID in Washington or Irish Aid in Dublin, we're extraordinarily well known and respected. So people do turn to us for help. We have a really great track record, and we do things a little different than a lot of NGOs. We never walk in with answers. We walk in with ears. We listen to what the local government and local communities want, and then try to work with them to see how we can use some of our experience and skills to help them.
I just want to revisit this because I'm forever in awe of it. What happens and how many occasions are there when you've responded to the disaster, things are settling down, and if the government, are they inclined, because of the reputation of concern, to let you do your thing, or are there situations, political situations, where they do not want anybody helping the situation, particularly if they're on the wrong side of the government, whatever the government initiative is? Are there many cases like that?
Yeah, well, there are, but I'd make 2 points right off the bat. One is that we don't take sides. So even when you want, you may be disposed to take a side, mm-hmm. because it's pretty obvious what's going on here. We don't. We stay out of that. We work very hard, although we were founded by two priests.
Yeah.
We work very hard to be non-religious, or at least evangelizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have a reputation of being neutral, and our focus is on people working with people to help themselves who want that kind of assistance. The governments vary wildly, I should say, as you can imagine. So in some countries, you must work through the government, and that's our preference, by the way, because they're in this, and we're much more effective where we can partner with governments, both at the national and local level.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some places where the government doesn't want to be involved,
right.
And they sort of tolerate your helping.
Yeah.
But we rarely run into a situation where the government is actively hostile towards us.
Yeah. Now, because why I keep coming back to that point is, what about, since a lot of those areas for those man-made wars and disasters, there's a very high level of corruption within, the leadership, and especially when there is a transition or a supposed transition taking place. And it would be, that would be the most horrific of all situations if you were there providing aid in a non-political, non-sectarian fashion, and the government wants to get out of there anyway because you're disrupting, or you're showing the world that most of this is due to corruption.
Yeah. The again, I would make 2 points. First, I've got to say, because this is a hot button for me, maybe because I'm new to the field, or relatively new, there is absolutely corruption in almost every country you work in. If you're working in the United States, you'd be battling some corruption in some governments. We've all seen that. But it's what we focus on, and we don't focus on all the good that happens, and all the well-meaning people, and all the government leaders that really are on the right side of this issue. So I'd make that point. The other is that we make it a point to say that we won't be part of it and we won't tolerate it. And people tend to leave us alone. And also, it's probably important to remember, Adrian, that we work in the most challenging parts of the most challenged countries. So even if we're in a Tanzania, we're working in the worst neighborhood in Arusha, and the most rural village in the hinterlands, and it's the last place that the government is going to get to touch. So we take on the toughest assignments, and I think the attitude is, if you want to do that, God bless you.
Yeah. Now, of setting up and of helping people after the immediate disaster is at least while the dust is settling, you make it known that you're there. And there are some, when we think of almost the impossible, and that is that clean water, basic education, stuff that we take for granted. you can start at a very, very nominal level and work from there,
mm-hmm.
which you have to basically do.
Absolutely. It's the thing that that I like to do the least in a way.
Mm.
And I think Concern is an organization that likes to do it the least. It's not that we don't think it's important and that we
right.
do it. We will be distributing water in the Philippines in the coming weeks
right.
and setting up shelters and doing that sort of thing. But what we really get excited about is when the dust settles
uh-huh.
and when the water is flowing at least the level it was before we arrived, to start to talk with community leaders about longer-term, sustainable, I hate to use these buzzwords,
right. I know,
but
yeah.
sustainable solutions where we're not needed. You know, one of our biggest programs in Africa, the one that I think it's probably my favorite, is teaching people to farm, especially women.
Absolutely.
There's a sort of an unwritten rule in the developing world that if you have $1,000 to invest and you want impact, invest it in a woman. Mm. Or a group of women, because the money tends to stay in the family and goes to
yeah.
things like food and education. So, but teaching women to farm and then farm better
mm-hmm.
and then form themselves into co-ops so they can not only feed their family but sell excess produce at local markets.
How successful
is
that?
It's incredibly successful. It's there are places now where we're sort of withdrawing from that work because we've done what we can and we'll move to
yeah.
another place. I was just in Haiti 3 years after the earthquake and visited a co-op in about 2 hours north of Port-au-Prince, about 300 women farmers that are growing mangoes and avocados.
Yeah.
3 years ago, they weren't farmers at all. Now they're at a point where they have doubled their production in 3 years from what they started with. And their per price pound that they sell stuff for has quadrupled because they're in co-ops and they're not taken
right.
advantage of and they have a voice. Now those people, those families are being fed. There's a little leftover money. Kids are starting to go to schools
right.
with Concern's help. We've built some schools and
yeah.
improving the quality of the teachers, which is also very important. So those kind of things, they will take hold. There's no going back for those women, and there are other programs like that that we run,
yeah.
but those are, those to me are the really exciting ones. It's a little bit, it's analogous to giving a person a fish or teaching them to fish.
Sure.
So we do give people fish, but we prefer to teach them to fish.
You know, human nature and human reaction hasn't changed that much over the decades, and I'm sure maybe we could go back a century or two when we hear about places like Haiti, and we do know that there's overcrowding. You talked about Port-au-Prince, you talk about that area, and it's very easy for us to say, why don't they move? Why don't they spread out? Why would they? You know, we're very good at least offering or allowing our imagination to something that sounds like it's basic common sense.
Right.
And yet, you know, it's just, A, it's not practical, and secondly, if you move away from the natural disaster areas, what are you going to do and how do you start?
Right. And the other thing is it's home. Whatever it is, and as bad as it is,
mm-hmm.
it's home. It's where you grew up, and that's difficult. So I think people are sort of wedded in some cases to the familiar.
Right.
And moving, you know, my parents immigrated from Ireland. My God, New York is filled with people of Irish ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back and I look at not just Irish immigrants, but particularly my family. I can't imagine my mother and father leaving cabin in Tipperary in the late 20s and packing a bag and coming here, but they did. But not everybody does. A lot of people stay put,
right.
and stay where they are.
Yeah.
And, but I think there's just some of it is inertia, but I think some of it is tied to home.
Right.
But
well, we can also, you know, there is a difference between leaving, you know, Cavan and Tipperary or Mayo or any of the other areas, particularly, you know, with after the famine and you know, Ireland's fight for independence and whatever. That was never, you know, many would say, well, the Irish always had wanderlust. Not so. Wanderlust is great. If you want to pick it as an alternative, successive governments, not just in Ireland, but have always treated immigration, you know, as if, you know, these are young people and they want to spread their wings and so forth. So even in our own background, there's a lot of denial that we've had with respect to, you know, again, immigration and the need for immigration and why we're still doing it.
Right. Well, Haiti is another good example of that. There are tons of Haitians who have left their country to come to New York. I think the Irish, I mean, that started with the famine, and that was probably born of necessity. But in later generations, in my parents' time, which would be the 20s, late 20s, I think it was born of opportunity. That in those days there just wasn't
And lack of opportunity in
Ireland.
Where they,
yeah, both my parents grew up in farming families, and so the eldest brother got the farm, and the others, you know, had to look around and make their way.
And there were big families, obviously.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about you and your own background. God knows there are pages of biographical information, but I just want to touch on a couple of them. You have served, maybe you still do, on the Board of Trustees for Arthur Page Society, Democratic Leadership Council, Board of Directors of Stanford Center for the Arts, Advisory Council Business Committee for the United Nations, and most recently, whoever made that decision, you know, to take you from a very, very, as president of the Xerox Corporation Foundation, to come with the amount of experience that you have and to come into an area, say, like Concern and take on Concern worldwide for the United States. That has to be a fairly hefty decision for you to make. Had you been involved with Concern? Did you know that much about Concern? What was your...
I did. It was a difficult decision to leave Xerox, but an easy decision to come to Concern. So that maybe needs a bit of explanation. But I had been on the board of Concern since 2008, so 5 years. And I'd traveled to some of the countries that Concern works in. I'd been to Haiti and Liberia and Tanzania and seen the work, you know, on the ground. And it's so inspiring, Adrian, and so motivating that it gets in your blood. That was one reason. I had been at Xerox for, are you ready, 42 years.
Wow.
So I had had a great career there, but it was time to do something else if I was going to do something else.
Right.
And then the third reason, you mentioned his name at the top of the show, but many of your listeners will recognize the name Tom Moran, who's involved in all things Irish in New York and in Ireland. He's on the board of Aer Lingus and was very involved in the peace talks and moving those along. And he's a great man and a very persuasive man. It was a scene out of a movie, but he asked if he could give me a lift one day from point A to point B, and he wouldn't let me out of the car until I at least agreed to think about it. So I agreed to think about it and talked to the family and came. And it's been great. It's a organization filled with largely young people, highly motivated, but very practical. You know, call them tough love and big hearts, you know.
Now, in the midst of all of the great work that CONCERN does, there is still within taking on, you know, continents, there is still a fair amount of AIDS and HIV areas, and somehow we thought, well, Gavi, you know, there was a time when there was no cure, there was no anything, and so forth. But it's very easy for us to talk about those particular areas of deadly diseases and in past tense. But yet, that's not the case.
Not
definitely, that doesn't translate when you come to places like
not the case
Africa.
At all, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. There's still, depends on the country, of course, but it's still a huge, huge problem.
But how do you even tackle that? That sounds like something that is so enormous that it goes far beyond the obvious necessity for funds and for money and whatever. What gives CONCERN the right and the experience to go into an area like that?
Well, we have some real expertise in that area that people people wouldn't automatically know. But we have a team of people that are very expert in AIDS and in treating AIDS. And we go at it in two ways. And we don't do it everywhere. Mm-hmm. We do it where there's a critical need and where the community wants that kind of help.
Right.
But we do it in two ways. One is education about how to avoid AIDS.
Right.
And encouraging people to get tested for AIDS and then practice abstinence if they're infected with AIDS. So there's a lot of educational work that goes on. And then there's a lot of work with our partners of getting drugs and medical help
right.
in on the ground to treat people already.
And much
infected.
Of that actually, in terms of the availability and indeed the supply of the drugs and of the medical help, if it's there and there is no recognizable means of getting it to the people, you know, sometimes we think, God, you know, America is great. We're all great because when we look at planes sitting on the tarmac ready to go to any place in the world where there is a disaster, we've got to be way up there. We ought to feel very good about ourselves. But isn't there a huge problem with respect to wherever these drops are made, and with the tremendous generosity that there is in this world here, if you drop a pallet of medical supplies and it can't get from that to those who need it in the first place, there's not too much to feel good about there.
No, it's the most frustrating thing in the world. And the last thing I did before coming over here to sit with you for this lovely interview. I was on a conference call with our partners in Dublin, CONCERN in Dublin and others. And we have four people now, three or four people on the ground in the Philippines.
Mm.
And by the end of next week, we'll probably be up to seven people. But the supplies are going into Manila, which is a different island than the islands that are most impacted by the, horrible typhoon, and they will sit there for much of it will sit there for a week or two until we can start to get distribution going in the islands that need it. The airports there are closed; they've been wiped out. So it's horribly frustrating. And one of the things I'm beginning to learn slowly is that in a crisis like the Philippines, you have to take a deep breath. You have to get in. Start talking to the government, as you pointed out, and see what they need. Start developing partnerships.
Right.
Do an assessment. But you can't start handing out water immediately. Now, the military can do that.
Yes.
And so we are sending some supplies into Manila.
Right.
And others are. And the military can do some airdrops and that kind of thing. And including our own military is on the scene. But to start to set up water distribution centers and food distribution centers and places for people to sleep. It's a couple of weeks away, I'm afraid.
Friends, my guest, who is Chief Executive Officer of Concern Worldwide, USA, is Joe Cahalan. And I want to ask you about the success of Concern Worldwide, USA. If you were to take New York and indeed Chicago, and if you were to take that or either one of those away, what impact is left? And what is your job in terms of spreading out so that you are getting the support of many different areas around the United States? Great work has been done in New York and again Chicago. Well, what about the rest of it? How do you plan to set up in many other areas, or is there a necessity to do that?
It's a great question. I don't think, we're thinking this through, since I'm relatively new, you rethink everything.
Yeah.
But my initial sense is that there probably isn't a need to set up physical offices
right. In
other places, particularly with radio and television and the internet and Facebook
whatever.
And all of that people are wedded. And
which wasn't the case if we go back, say, 25 years ago.
No, not at all.
If you didn't have the storefront, you didn't have a business.
Yes, not at all. No, but things have changed. And, of course, much of our money comes from outside New York and Chicago. We
sure.
get funding from the Kellogg Foundation in the Midwest,
yeah.
from the Gates Foundation in the far west,
right.
USAID and other government
yep.
funding in Washington. We get money from private donors in
right.
Boston and Philadelphia, as you'd imagine, and other major
right.
cities. And
by the same token.
So, but there is more yeah. potential.
But you have to come back to, no matter how much money you get, you're still locked into 8% of that money available to run the entire operation.
Organization, right.
Organization, so that it's uphill
yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, yeah. But we are growing, and we've done well over the last few years. Getting this Gates grant that I mentioned was
right.
huge for us. They actually came to Concern. It's another example of how Concern is thought about. They actually came to Concern and asked us to apply for a grant. And we
That's
did, and we
good.
Got it, $40 million over a period of several years, to do some really interesting work around innovative solutions to old problems.
Mm-hmm.
But we feel strongly that when people give us money, that they're not, I don't even like to use the word give us money, when they
right.
invest in our work, that we have a responsibility not to be wasting money and doing things
right.
that aren't core to the mission. So
and that really hasn't changed. Has
not
it?
At all. That's been a hallmark of Concern for forever since,
yeah.
you're right, 1968 when it started right. as a result of the famine in Biafra.
That's right.
And the outpouring of the Irish
45
people.
45 solid years ago. Yeah. Now I want to rake the coals just in case everybody thinks that you just happened to be born rich and lucky and everything. Your mother was actually an Irish immigrant from Cavan.
Correct. Kilnaleck.
Kilnaleck. And your father?
From Borrisicane in County Tipperary.
And now, they came to New York?
Yes, separately.
Separately.
Right, didn't
okay.
know each other.
And your mother your mother and indeed your father, when they were married, they had a kind of the... they wound up in a unique situation in terms of becoming the practical sole keepers of one of the greatest mansions of New York. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a great. I think it's a great story. I call it the kindness of two strangers, and it changed our lives. My mother got a job as a live-in maid
mm-hmm.
in a wealthy suburb, Rye, New York, and my father, a landscaper in Portchester, New York.
Right.
One of the things I wished I'd asked them along the way is how they met, but I imagine that I know the Irish Help had Mondays off,
mm-hmm.
so I imagine they met at church or in a social somewhere.
Right.
The family that my mother lived with were very good people and very good to her, so when she announced that she was engaged to Joe Cahalan,
mm-hmm.
my father, Mr. Pell, William Pell, wanted to meet my father to, I suppose, pass judgment on him.
Absolutely.
So my father describes going over in his wedding funeral suit for dinner, and he must have acquitted himself pretty well, because at the end of the dinner, Mr. Pell said, there's nothing wrong with your work, good hard labor, but it's seasonal, you don't have any benefits, and if you'd like, I'd like to see if I can get you something down at the bank.
Right.
So my father explained that he had limited education, and he said, that's all right, maybe we can work something out if you're game. So he said, come over here Monday morning at 7:30, and we'll go into the bank. And long story short, he hired him at the bank as a sort of a non-uniform doorman.
Mm-hmm.
My father explains that he got a second wedding funeral suit, so he had an option now, he had two suits. And he would just greet customers at the bank, and he was a great storyteller, a great Irishman, I think, and treated people very well, whether you were a janitor or a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And he struck up passing acquaintances with these very wealthy people that would visit the bank on Wall Street. And one of them was a man named Isaac Brokaw, who had made a fortune in textile business and owned a mansion on 79th Street and 5th Avenue.
Right.
For those listeners who may not know the neighborhood or don't come from New York, it's one of the most fashionable addresses in the city of New York. And
our current mayor, indeed, is very proud and wouldn't even bother moving to Gracie Mansion because right, actually, only a few doors away, that's where Bloomberg lives.
Yeah. A man who could live anywhere.
Yeah, and then, But anyway, go ahead.
So Mr. Brokaw asked my father if he explained that he had already discussed this with the bank, and my father could keep his job at the bank, and he would like him to move in. He would outfit an apartment for my older sister, I wasn't born yet, and my parents in the mansion. It was modeled after a French chateau with turrets and a lawn around it and a big high wall and gorgeous stone mansion. And that my parents would live there and make sure that the house wasn't burglarized or a pipe didn't leak or there were no vandals around. And so we moved to 79th Street and 5th Avenue. And then some years later, he sold the building to a professional society for their offices, and in the deed of sale mandated that as long as they were there in that building, that my parents would be there and that my father would be hired to run the building. And so I call it, as I said, the kindness of two strangers, the banker and the textile billionaire, or probably not a billionaire then, but he would be today.
Yeah.
We grew up in a very elite area, and I went, because of that, I went to St. Ignatius Loyola Grammar School on 84th Street and Park Avenue,
yes,
run by the Jesuits and the Sisters of Charity.
Uh-huh.
The Jesuits got a hold of me.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Xavier High School in Manhattan and Fordham College in the Bronx, all Jesuit, and they just guided me through. And I was the only one of my generation to go to college. And it was because of growing up in that neighborhood and circumstances. And that's one of the reasons that calls me to the work of concern.
Right.
That we need to help other people.
You've also, though, you spent many an afternoon up in Gaelic Park.
Uh-huh.
As indeed, and I believe it was Celtic Park before it became Gaelic Park. But anyway, I'm sure that many of our listeners will correct me if that's wrong. That was a great mecca for not only Irish immigrants, but again, introduction to the first generation and indeed after that second generation. This was a place, this was a meeting place for basically Irish. And on your mother's side, of course, it would have to be football, Catherine.
Right, exactly.
And again from Tipperary, from Nina. What townland do they come from, actually? It's near Nina.
It's Burrisachane is the town.
Burrisachane, yeah.
And if you want to get the town land, if you want to be that finite, it's Rodine.
Rodine. So you grew up in a very you had many privileges that maybe a lot of other people didn't have, but you were definitely in. You got off to a good start, as it were.
Oh, I got off to a great start, and Sundays during football and hurling seasons were, mass, home for a quick bite, and up to, I think I called it always Gaelic Park, I believe.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about that. I think the O'Donnell family ran.
Oh, yes, indeed.
From County Kerry, as I recall.
I served my time, actually, in Gaelic Park for somebody who wouldn't know a football from a rugby ball. I say that I spent, because as a musician I worked with Mickey Carton and John O'Neill and on the little bandstand that was in Gaelic Park every Sunday afternoon for a couple of decades.
Well, we probably crossed paths.
We probably did.
Yeah.
No, the point that I wanted to make was, though, that whereas circumstances might have been in hindsight, somewhat privileged, you definitely knew that the work ethic of your mother and your father was primary. In there was no schluffing off.
No, no.
that was the kind of
no. My parents were very instrumental. I mean, it's one of those things, Adrian, that I never consciously thought about going to college. It was always a given.
A given.
And I don't know where that came from, but it was never a conscious decision. It just
how many were in
happened.
Your family?
Just my sister and I. She's 4 years older. And unfortunately, back then, because she was a young girl, as sure as I was that I was going to college, she was equally certain she wasn't.
Uh-huh.
But she's smarter than I am. That's not self-effacing. That's the reality. And she went on. She also valued education greatly and became long-term chair of the Board of Education in Hamden, Connecticut, serving with Yale professors.
How about that? And also, as another, in case those think that indeed your Irishness only started after you left Xerox, you are and have been a board member of the Irish Repertory Theatre and a great source of contact and support, for the Irish Rep. So somewhere along the way, you never got that far away. I mean, even tracing Xavier into Fordham and into a career, you never got that far away from your own.
No, I think there were a couple of other factors, Adrian. Well, certainly my parents, but also because we lived in that mansion.
Yeah,
we had the run of these huge living rooms and guest rooms, and so the place became the party central for the family. So I countless Saturday nights of a couple of kegs of beer in the bathtub, and an accordion player and a fiddler and maybe a banjo player, and Irish missionaries. Maybe that's another reason I'm at concern. Who were visiting New York, home for holidays, coming to visit and say a few words and raise a few dollars. And the thing if there's one line that will always make me cry, it's when I'm home visiting my cousin. When I'm home, mm-hmm. That's the line. When I'm in Ireland visiting my cousins, and one of them is on the phone with somebody else, and they say, "Joe is home."
Wow.
That makes me cry.
Okay, now I think there are people, particularly if you have been listening to my guest Joseph Cahalan, Chief Executive Officer of Concern Worldwide US. I think probably the best thing we can do at this point is direct people to the website to really know and to get the feeling as to how, at whatever level, we can support. Many of us think that an organization like Concern would only be relying upon an organization serving reaching more than 8.5 million people in 25 countries with 3,200 in personnel, what can our meager contribution do, and where do we fit in? That website isn't enough, I think, to motivate anybody and say, you're not bashful.
Right. It's concern.
You can afford.
Yeah, it's concernusa.org.
Mm-hmm.
No amount is too little. You'll see some suggestions there on the website.
Right.
If you fish around, that for $5 you can buy books for a classroom. For I don't want to make
right.
them up, but for a modest amount of money you can dig a well in a community that has no clean water. So
that
no,
is why you should go to the website, because when you see what a relatively small amount of money can do in an area that is desperate, you don't even... The dictionary does not do justice to desperation until you see exactly what a little amount of money can do.
Yep.
It's coming up to the holiday season, the Christmas season, the season of giving, and indeed there are hundreds, if not thousands, of organizations doing great work. If you pick one that is doing more for humanity than concern, then send us an email. Or send an email indeed to concernusa.org.
Right. We would appreciate it.
Joe Cahalan, again, Chief Executive Officer at Concern Worldwide USA. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
The Concern Worldwide Seeds of Hope annual award dinner is going to take place on December 9th at the Waldorf Astoria here in New York. And the guest of honor for this year is Christopher Mueller, who is the CEO of Aer Lingus. Okay, now I'll give you a telephone number as well, 212-557-8000. And the website, concernusa.org.